Dear wonderful listeners, if you're looking to define your brand's core message but aren't sure where to start, that's where Smart Beauty can help. We're offering a 90-minute deep dive into your brand to give you clear action points on your messaging and strategy to help you grow and scale, so that you can get noticed by customers, retailers, and investors, and start to see sales soar. And the cost of this deep dive is redeemable against any larger project you work with us on, so you get all of that insight and value with minimal risk. We're looking for a few new clients who are ready to see amazing results. Just email hello@smartbeautycreative.com to find out more. Hello and welcome to the Smart Beauty Podcast. I'm your host, Viola Levy, beauty journalist and founder of copy-led branding agency, Smart Beauty Creative. We're here to create your brand voice and craft the story behind it. I'm thrilled to be joined today by the brilliant Anna Vale, a marketing powerhouse who's helped transform beauty brands across three continents. Currently based in New York, Anna brings her razor-sharp insights from boardrooms of legacy beauty giants to the creative hubs of today's most exciting indie brands. In this chat, we pull back the curtain on the beauty industry's most compelling challenges, how small brands can compete with industry titans, the secrets to landing those coveted Sephora and Ulta partnerships, and the strategic moves that transform niche products into household names. Anna shares the unfiltered truth about what it takes to build a beauty brand in today's saturated market, from viral marketing moments to sustainable growth strategies that actually work. Whether you're building your own beauty empire or simply want to understand the business genius behind your favourite products, Anna's perspective is enlightening and refreshingly candid. Really enjoyed this chat and hope you will too. So Anna, thank you so much for joining me. Now, you've worked with both indie and legacy beauty brands. It'd be great to hear what are some of the unique challenges that indie beauty brands are facing, things like when they're looking to scale, and how do you help these brands kind of navigate those challenges?
Viola, thank you so much for having me as well. I'm happy and excited to be here. Yeah. So, you know, it's really interesting having both sides of the beauty spectrum, the legacy brands and then the indie brands. And obviously indie comes in all shapes and sizes. You come from the smallest startups through to indie brands that are on the way to acquisition. They're nine-figure strong, you know. But I think some of the really interesting challenges that you can really see if you've seen what happens once they've reached legacy size or once they've been acquired into a corporation, a lot of the issues, and I don't want to speak out of turn, but some of the things I see often is normally when a brand is leveling up, they don't necessarily have the know-how across the business. So there are some people in the company that know what needs to be done, but they don't necessarily have the team at that level. They have incredible people in the brand who are very siloed and very, they're very targeted at what they're delivering, but they don't have the experience to see across the board and how it all joins together. So we start with experiences one. They've got great experience, but maybe not for that next level. The other area that is always a conversation and always something that has to be addressed pretty quickly is how comfortable brands are for leveling up their budget. Because if you need to scale, you need to scale budget. It doesn't happen on its own. You obviously have to have all the organic activity happening and building community. But on the other side, you need to be fueling it with paid media and activations and events, anything where you need budget, basically. So it's like, how comfortable is the brand about using more budget and spending more budget with the ROI? And with that, when you talk about budget, it's how comfortable is the brand testing and learning? Because what you see your competitors doing is not necessarily going to be right for you. So you could say, brand X, you know, they're doing like pop-ups all over the place. Let's do it because we know it's working and they're growing. You're like, well, that's not where your consumer is. So should we be spending in the right place? So it's really a balancing act. There is no There is no rule of thumb. I think you need to really be clear on who the customer is, who you're scaling to reach as well, because it's not just scaling up the size of the brand. It could be like going deeper into the customer set you have, or it could be finding new customers, which is also scaling, right? Or it could be going onto a new platform or a new retailer. So there's so many areas you have to work with, and you it's there isn't really like one answer that says what needs to be done, but the challenges normally are pretty similar.
Yeah, and I think that there's sometimes a naivety where pricing is concerned. Like I was speaking to somebody else about this before, and they said, you know, when these sort of indie brands in the early stages, they're setting their prices, but they're not factoring in the need to scale. I mean, do you find that is a common kind of occurrence that people
Prices of product,
kind of,
product prices. I mean, look, I think pricing is really interesting because you have to make sure that you're covering COGS, and you have to make sure that you're thinking about the difference, the cost of marketing to build your brand, and then what it is to go into the retailer, and but at the end of the day, your pricing has to reflect it has to reflect the quality of your products. And it has to reflect who that target market is. So if you are pricing too high, well, then everything else around it needs to show that the value is there. If you've priced too high and you don't have the value for these products, then yeah, it's an issue. But I think, again, there's a I'm not, going to say someone's priced incorrectly, but there's so much data to help guide how you price. And I would say if you are starting out, it's probably one of the most important things to spend time on and invest in the right analytic tools to see where where you fit into the industry and what type of benchmarks you're trying to hit for your brand.
No, 100%. And you know, you've worked in the Middle East, you've worked obviously in the UK, and now you're in the US. So how does your kind of strategy change depending on the region, in sort of broad general terms, would you say?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. So, when I was in the UK, I was really overseeing like UK and Ireland, and I was like deep in. I knew everything about the UK. I knew everything about every city in the UK. So, like Manchester was different to London, and Edinburgh was different to Glasgow, and Belfast was different to Dublin. Like, I knew the ins and the outs of the customer, the editors, everything about it, and what worked, what didn't. Then when I moved to New York, even though I was in the US, I was running global. So I then had to learn the difference between China and Poland and Japan and
Oh
Hong
gosh,
Kong
next
and
level.
France and Russia. And, and obviously there were teams in every country that were guiding and whatever, but the cultural nuances were so major that as a global team, even though you're a global team setting global strategy, the strength had to come from within the country because you cannot take a global brand and be like, hello, we've arrived. It's going to work here in a new country, right? And so that was a huge learning curve. And also really understanding cultural differences to a whole nother level. I remember the first time I went to Japan, my boss sat me down and basically said, do this, don't do that, don't turn your back, make sure you're using two hands when you take a business card. Like, I remember all of the kind of prep work, and it was the most amazing
Imagine.
trip. But she was like, these are the things you have to remember to be taken seriously when you arrive and being polite. So that was one area. And then, when I went to different countries, it was always the same, but I would have to really understand the culture. And once you understand the culture, you understand how the consumer shops. So that was super interesting. Then in more recent, and I lived in the Middle East, which again was different because I was helping international brands come into the region. So I was then on the other side where I was like, okay, big American brand, like you can't just enter the region like that. We're going to have to, work with you to do some other things. And I will not take credit for this. And I wasn't the one leading the campaign, but one of the best campaigns I ever saw when I lived in Dubai, Hourglass was a client at the agency I worked at.
Lovely
And
brand.
this was like a beautiful brand. And it wasn't this wasn't our work. We did some other work with them. But they had that amazing anti-animal cruelty campaign where they had the horse with the big eyelashes. And they basically reshot it for Arabian stallions. So they were able to use it across the Middle East, which was just amazing. Like they changed the type of horse, or they just really respected the culture so they could enter. And then here's the other thing, when I work with American brands and American teams, they're like, yay, we want to crack Europe. I'm like, okay, everyone, take a deep breath. Europe, I don't know how many countries it is now. Let's say like nearly 30 countries. Like, you can't just crack Europe. Like, you can't go to Russia and sell your products in the same way you'd go to France and sell your products. It's the same thing. So I think what's happened over the years of experience I've had, each phase has created a new learning path for me, to be honest. And until you're in it, it's very hard to understand those differences.
No, I could imagine. And you get a lot of brands that are now kind of vying to go sort of go viral on TikTok, or they want that kind of big moment. But then again, you sort of want them to kind of have long-term growth as well. And how do you kind of balance the two? So you're ensuring that they're going to stick around and have longevity, because a lot of brands, they can be a viral overnight sensation, but then they're, gone the next day, pretty much the next day. So how do you kind of balance that? So, you want a campaign, for example, to have an impact, but then you also want to sustain that kind of long-term growth over time.
Yeah, no, I think it's that, that's a huge problem for some brands. They go viral and then they can't anniversary it because virality, you can influence virality, but you can't be certain it's going to happen, and the reason you use the word viral is because it went viral. It wasn't strategic. You can certainly do strategic things that get you to virality, but how do you sustain? I think it's really important for brands to balance out what their calendar looks like, or what their brand like infrastructure looks like. What are the hero products? What are the core products? So it's almost like, who's your main actress and who's the supporting cast?
Yeah, nice way
And
of
you
putting it.
have yeah and you have to make sure that you have a really balanced strategy to support both. So if your hero product goes viral, your supporting cast is also there that you're going to be link selling and pushing and having multiple campaigns. And certainly in the early days, brands are looking at launching new SKUs over and over again, which you kind of need to do for momentum and buzz and excitement. But what a lot of brands think about is their old SKUs are new to so many people that don't even know about the brand. So you have to have multiple strategies running at the same time. And we go back to what we were saying before about budget. Like, in order to have all those different strategies running, how comfortable are these brands with the budget spend that are supporting this activity?
No, definitely. There's just so many things to consider, isn't there? And then you get these kind of heritage brands that I guess are struggling at the moment to keep up with the kind of new sort of young indie brands that are kind of creating more buzz and people are, getting more excited about. And I feel like they're in a bit of a bind, because I think they're trying to be kind of new and innovative and sort of exciting, but then there are people that are saying, oh, well, they've kind of strayed away from their original values that made everyone fall in love with them. So would you say it's kind of a similar thing, that there needs to be a, sort of various different strategies going on, that they can sort of do the more exciting stuff, but then also show that they still haven't sort of forgotten who they are?
Yeah, absolutely. So, you look at some of the big brands I worked on, and their hero SKU was like triple, quadruple the size of a sister brand. Just the value of one of those hero SKUs. The revenue that just one SKU made was bigger than most brands that exist out there in the industry. So you can see why they have to be extremely precious and careful around parts of the brand. But if I was working on a legacy brand, I would be fighting now, as in, like, respect it. I know all this has to happen. I know all of this is really important, but we have to have some agility to move fast. Otherwise, we're going to get left behind. And that's what's happened, that when you're in a big brand for very good reasons, things take time. You know, the product development takes time, the innovation takes time, the strategy build takes time, the legal approvals take time, and all of that can't happen, you know, simultaneously. It's like one takes time, then the next takes time. Like, you know, I always joke, and this is it's true, you know. The first time I worked with one of my first and very favorite client, I presented this big strategy. They didn't interrupt me. They didn't stop me on page two. And at the end of the deck, I was like, okay, feedback. They're like, cool, go for it. And I was like, what? And
Gosh,
they were like, go for it. We want you to do this. I'm like, do what? Which bit? And they're like, go for it,
same.
all of it. And I was so kind of like, I was so ready for like corporate meetings to like fight me on page one, page two, question, ask for more information. Then at the end of the deck, it would be like, okay, now you need to like prepare it again for the next round of meetings, and then again for the next round of meetings. And by which time the competition's already done it. It's out of date. And I haven't been in corporate for a while now. So obviously I don't want to generalize, but all I'm saying is some of the experiences is that there are ways of working that have to be in place because the business is so big. But because of that, it slows down innovation.
Yeah, and things like sustainability, like it's harder for them to turn the ship around, isn't it, as opposed to the kind of smaller, more agile brands. In a way, I guess they have an advantage, these smaller brands, because they can be more dynamic and turn things around in a lot shorter time frame.
Yes and no. So I think with smaller brands, it's just really expensive to do as well. So you have that piece. With the bigger companies, they actually have, they, I believe they have the advantage because they have so many brands and so many products that it becomes cheaper and easier to do, because obviously the more packaging you buy, the cheaper, you know, the cheaper it is. So I don't know where the issue is, but I actually think the big companies should be leading by example when it comes to sustainability. And there should be more ways of the bigger companies paving the way and supporting the smaller brands to also have a better sustainable output.
Yeah, I mean, do you see things changing in any time soon when it comes to brand, like you say, bigger companies leading the way? Because you get a lot of these new indie brands sort of shouting about their sustainable credentials, but yeah, we're not sort of seeing it across the board as yet.
You know, I kind of feel like it's a $1 billion question if things are going to change. I guess we are going to see incremental change because we have to
Consumers
change
are
the beauty
demanding it.
industry. Yeah, so we are going to see change. I don't know at what pace. I think the more access brands have, and the easier to access good packaging, good ingredients, you know, different sustainable ways of working, it's going to be easier. It's going to be more equitable, right? So I think we are going to see change because we have to, but the pace is going to be interesting, because you can't just be like, oh yeah, packaging's recyclable now. Like, yeah, and what?
Tell us
You know,
something.
because the benchmark has changed. You know, the bar has been raised, so that's really your starting point. Like, it's expected now, so we are going to see change. I don't know if we're going to see like major, like newsworthy change, but we are going to be seeing change for sure.
And you specialize in brands that are stocked in Sephora and Ulta. What do you think kind of sets these retailers apart in the beauty industry, and how can kind of brands best succeed within the within those environments, would you say?
So I mean, I work with brands all over, right? So I work with brands at Credo and Bluemercury, and but a lot is Sephora and Ulta brands. And I think there's two things. I mean, they're very, very, let's say Sephora and Ulta, like, they're very different retailers. They have their own customers, but then they have an overlap of customers as well. And even where I live, like, there's literally like a Sephora and Ulta within three blocks of each other. And you see people walking down the street holding both bags, but they're there for different reasons. Like they may be going into Ulta to get some like hair coloring products, or and then they'll go into Sephora to buy like a Tower 28 blush. You know, they're there for different reasons. But I think what they have is the size of the business. So for Ulta, like it's all over the US, like it's a huge, huge company. And then for Sephora, it's a huge company, but it's not doesn't have as many, the footprint isn't as big. A few things that really stand out to me is how they build loyalty. So some of the work I do is really understanding, what traffic have you got on your own D2C website, but do they actually go off and buy at Sephora? Because they've done the research and they've used your website as education and research and what have you. But they've gone off to Sephora because they get their points. I do it. I do it myself. I completely do it myself. I want to make sure I know what I'm buying, but I'll probably go and like get my points and get up to the next level. And
I do
once
that
I've
with
hit
Space NK
Rouge,
in this country.
yeah. Well, actually, I was in London last week and I got my Space NK. I bought Ultraviolet, which is actually now coming to America from Australia, but I've been buying it in the UK for years. And I went into Space NK and they're like, oh, here's your membership card. You get £10 off next time. I'm like, oh, didn't sign up for that, but sure, I'll take it. But you can see why people would do that because there's loyalty. You get special offers. So I do think Ulta and Sephora do the loyalty really, really well. Sephora has I think it has the business of, well, it has it, it really looks to build brands and bring on smaller brands and be a platform for them. Where Ulta, they do that, but you have bigger brands at Ulta and help really fuel the brand to like gigantic size. So, they really are huge retailers in the beauty industry now. But don't ever underestimate Bluemercury and Credo and some of the smaller places where you can have such incredible partnerships and really grow and learn who your customer is in the US.
No, definitely. And what do you think retailers are really looking for at the moment to, in general, when taking on new brands? Like, what are the kind of key things that have stood out to you, with the clients that you've worked with?
So this is opinion. This is not like coming from a retailer's voice, but I think we've got to a point where beauty is so saturated. There are so many brands, and even now I'm like, oh, that brand has just rebranded and it looks like this brand, like a hair brand just relaunched recently. I'm like, that looks like the brand that relaunched 3 weeks ago. And they're in different retailers, but like and there's a lot of design agencies and there's a few big ones everyone wants to work with. So then things are starting to look the same. So brands are like really overlapping now. So a retailer is looking for something really new and exciting, but also a category that they think they can grow in. So they're not just going to take on a really innovative brand that no one has a clue how to use or what to do, and no one even knows it exists. But they are looking for like something new and exciting. They're looking for incrementality as well. So can this brand bring in a new customer? And I think that is one of the biggest things, because you look at Target, Ulta, Sephora, like they know who their customer is. But if they bring in a new brand, is that brand also going to be bringing in a new customer? Because brands are looking for customers, so are retailers. So I think there's that piece, which makes it harder for a smaller brand. It makes it really hard for a smaller brand because they only have so many customers. The viral piece that we were just talking about attracts retailers, no doubt. Like no doubt, if there's a brand that's gone viral, everyone's talking about it, they're
The
seeing it
carrot.
everywhere. That they're like, oh, we want a piece of that. We want that brand to be available here. Of course. Like just look at some of the brands Sephora has just taken on in this round of new brands. Like it's a really interesting mix. It's a really interesting mix. Some of them are super obvious, and of course, like why is it not a Sephora? Like, thank God it's now there. Some of the other brands, I'm like, oh, how interesting that we've taken that brand on, but they've had a viral moment, or they're just filling a void that they don't currently have within their mix of business.
Yeah, I mean, without naming names, what kind of jumps out at you at sort of like, well, that's a bit of a surprise why they took that brand on? Like, what kind of
You know,
element?
I can't remember
Yeah.
the name of it, but I can see it in my head. I can't remember the name, but it was more of it was a very niche brand, very, very niche, but they don't have anything like that. They don't have anything like that there.
Yeah.
So it completely makes sense why they would bring a brand like that in,
Because a lot
because
of
it's a white space.
yeah. And a lot of sort of brands are saying now that kind of celebrity-led beauty brands are kind of monopolizing the retail space. Would you say that's kind of a fair assessment, or are they just being a bit bitter about why they couldn't get in there?
It depends. Are you hearing that in the UK
Yeah.
specifically? Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it completely depends. I am not a celebrity brand fan. So there are amazing brands. Like Rare Beauty is one of my favorite brands, but I think what they've done with that brand is way beyond any other brand has ever done.
Yeah.
And like Rode has done an incredible job, but there are other brands that like slap their name on a product and expect it to do
Yeah.
well. I think it really depends on the brand and
Sure.
depends what they're offering, depends who the team is. One brand that like killed me to see the space they took, but they're not there anymore. Like JLo, she took a whole end cap at Sephora, and I'm like, I can see why, but I'm like, there are so many better brands out there that I would want
Yeah.
to use.
Yeah.
But yeah, I'm kind of a bit indifferent to that. But I honestly don't think celebrity brands are taking over the space. I really don't. I don't. I think the ones that are doing it well deserve the space.
Yeah.
And I think if indie brands are finding reasons why they haven't managed to get in, I don't think that's the only reason. There'll be other reasons.
No, I think it was a brand that went on TikTok and said, I think the founder was saying that, I just find it so difficult because all these celebrity brands are now kind of coming in and just sort of, yeah, like I say, taking attention away from sort of the non-celebrity indie startups. But I guess going back to what you were saying, it's that the celebrity brands do have the better potential to go viral because the celebrity has that clout and the follower count on social media. And I imagine retailers kind of really go for that.
100%,
Yeah.
100%. And you know how hard it is to build a community and grow your following on social. Like it's like the community piece is the most important, and you need real people doing that, and you need to have likability and good products and conversation. But to grow following is so hard now. And like following really doesn't mean a huge amount, but for a celebrity, they've already got that inbuilt following and
Yeah.
community. So they're already miles, if not millions, of followers ahead of indie brands.
Yeah.
So if you think an indie brand starts with like 10, 20,000, then they get up to 40,000, then they get up to 70,000, then they hit 100,000, which is a really huge milestone. A celebrity launches their brand when they've already got multiple millions of followers. So it's really hard to make comparisons.
Yeah. And also, you talk about JLo and that brand sort of not being in Sephora anymore. And I guess it goes to show that even though they have got millions of followers, they might not be the customers for their beauty brand. Would you say that's kind of comes into play?
I don't know. It could have been that it's not the customer. It could have been that the products were bought once, but no one repeat purchased because they weren't that good. I have no idea. I have
Yeah.
no idea. But what I do know is there are amazing body brands out there. And as a beauty user, I probably would have bought a product from a brand that has integrity.
Yeah,
You
for
know,
sure.
and I'm not generalizing. I just pulled out one brand, and actually I very rarely name brands because I like to be careful, but it was one brand that annoyed me because I'm like, it doesn't it was more the brand, not the retailer. It was more that I was like, why do you need this? Why do you need to
Yeah.
create this?
It's not earned its stripes in that sense.
Yeah, and I think customers are really, really intelligent. Customers are really intelligent, and
Yeah.
they soon figure it out.
And you work with a lot of female-founded brands. Do you think something I talk about a lot on the on the show is how kind of founders, especially female founders, and also expected to kind of be influencers on top of that, and they're expected to be the face and the ambassador of the brand more so than male founders. Do you think that's accurate?
God, that's so interesting that you say that. That's so interesting. And I'm now like racking my brain with male founders and whether they are as front facing. I don't know if it's specific just to women, but I do think as a founder, there is an expectation to show up. And probably it feels more focused on female founders because there's more of them right now. But yes, I do think that's a huge change to what we used to see, that as a founder, you need to resonate with your customers, the reason you've launched these products is because you were looking for something, or the reason you launched these products is because you have a bad hair day, or reason you launched these products is you were running and your knees got sore, like whatever it is, and your customer's like, oh yeah, me too. I'm going to buy that brand because she's like me and I can be like her. So I do think there is that level of expectation because you do need to be able to connect. And to a certain degree, some of the founders out there now are almost celebrity status, right? Because they've got such big communities and such big following that people want to be around them, want to meet them, which is why these personal appearances and community gatherings are so important now, because you're connecting with real people. And at the end of the day, the founder is a real person. But it's a huge amount of pressure because you have to show up. You have to show up authentically. You also still have to run the business. And a lot of the time, the founder is the CEO as well. So you're running a business and you're showing up on social media. And there's a lot to cover. It's almost like multiple roles you're playing.
I think my favorite example of that is Katie Storino. I think she's amazing, the way she's sort of shows up and is, yeah, she's just very much like this, really amazing kind of ambassador for her brand, and she lives it. You can tell she's like 100% the philosophy behind Mega Babe and what it stands for. She is, definitely is the walking ambassador for that brand for sure. She lives it completely.
And she made the brand because she needed, like, she was looking for products that worked for her. So she really is the brand, right? She lives and breathes the brand, and she is amazing. And when you watch her on social, and like, you really like, and you're like, oh, I could go and have coffee with her, right?
She
You
comes
could feel
across like your
like that.
best friend.
Oh, completely, completely. And there are a lot of like really amazing founders that do come across like that too. But then there's the other side where founders are not that. They had an idea, they wanted to turn it into a business, and that was it. They don't want to be the face, they don't want to do that. And that's okay as well. But you do have to have some people talking on behalf of the brand. So that's when you layer in, do we need ambassadors? Do we elevate the CMO or the president? Like, who's going to be talking on behalf of the brand if it isn't the founder? And that's okay, but you have to be very clear that that's their responsibility.
I mean, do you think that's where kind of brand story and tone of voice come into play? In terms of, something that people are able to connect and engage with, if not kind of a figurehead.
Yeah, absolutely. I know this is your expertise, but absolutely, I think there's two things that you always need to remember when you're running a brand, whether you're a founder or working within the business as a leader. But it's, what's your why? Don't steer away from why you've got this brand. And then the other piece is thinking about the customer. And I always call it, I had an amazing trainer for many, many years when I was at Estée Lauder called Penny Blake. And she used to call it the Whiffen statement. Is what's in it for me? So you must always think about the customer. So when they see your product, they will say, well, what's in it for me? Like, why should I buy this? So, like, For me, it's the why and the with them. Like, why are we doing this brand? And then what's in it for the customer? And together, those two things have to be anchored in a really strong story.
100%. It's like tapping into their like pain points, for lack of a better term, and
Yes.
really understanding like what is their problem and how are we solving it, I guess.
Yeah, that would be amazing, wouldn't it? It'd be like new customer research. What's your problem? But it
Yeah.
really is, right? It really is. It's like, why do you need this? It's like, let's be honest. I mean, I probably don't need the 15 blushes that I have, but why did I buy them? Probably because they look cool and they look really lovely to blend when I was scrolling on Instagram. And then the next one, I was like, oh, that's a nice formula. I saw someone put on TikTok, so I bought that one. And, you know, why are you buying them? Because you're seeing other people that you feel similar to. And that's how that's, and they're telling a story that resonates. And that's why you're buying. So, yeah,
No, it makes sense.
the psychology.
I find all that fascinating. I could totally nerd out on the consumer psychology side of things.
I could spend hours just doing like consumer like interviews to build insights. I do it as one of my services, but I try not to spend too much time because it's a big project. But talking to customers and like really unlocking like their why is so fascinating. It's so fascinating. Or even like just going into like Sephora. Like being in there buying stuff, but like watching what other people buy and how they travel around the store is that's a superpower if you can figure that piece out.
No, I completely agree. And just talk about a bit more about your career for a second. So, how do what are your kind of ideal clients that you work with, and how can people kind of what kind of people sort of, as I say, would you consider your ideal client, and how can people kind of work with you?
My sweet spot is really working with brands that have got proof of concept, they've got to a certain point, and they're looking for that next level of growth. And sometimes that next level of growth is entering one of the retailers we've spoken about, or they're in the retailer and they're like, okay, we need to grow now, you know. So they typically are VC or PE backed. They're not a big corporate company. There's a founder, there's a team, a smaller team in place where I can really come in and help level up team and strategies and really work between the team and then maybe the founder or the CEO. And I can really fill that void and help everyone level up really for that next level of growth.
Yeah, and you.
And
Yeah,
yeah.
carry on.
No, go ahead.
And you're a fractional CMO. So do you think that's kind of a good idea for brands at that level who maybe can't afford to take someone on full time?
Yeah, you know, I've played around with what I call myself. And quite honestly, I ended up calling myself a fractional CMO because people started to understand it. But I'm a marketing leader, which ultimately is a CMO, but I'm a marketing leader. I'm not a marketing manager. And a fractional CMO is, or any fractional talent. So I'm a member of the board as well. And what we have there is fractional talent. So when you need something done within the business, but you don't want to take on an entire team or bring in a CFO, a COO, a CMO, bringing in fractional talent means that you get the work done with all the talent and expertise, fraction of the time, which means fraction of the cost. And often those types of roles are brought in to solve a problem. Sometimes it's like, we need to level up. We don't know how to. Okay, cool. Come in for 6 months, learn. And then, okay, we've got this now. We've got this. We know what to do next. Other times, brands are almost like practicing, like, oh, could we do with this in the business? Let's test it out.
So it's like
And
consultancy, but
oh, completely. It's consulting. Yeah, no, it's absolutely consulting. It's consulting. So I do advisory, which is literally advising what they need to do next. I do consulting, which is fractional CMO, where I do the strategy and do the execution work. And typically that includes leadership of the team because there's normally not someone in place doing the leadership and really help brands figure out what they need to do next. But with fractional work, any role could be fractional ultimately when a business needs it. And there's a lot of brands now that just run their business. If I've launched a brand, I would set up a whole fractional team.
Really?
Yeah, I really would because I wouldn't want all the overheads of full-time staff now. I'm talking about if I just launched a brand. Okay, you get to a certain point where you have to have team in place. But if I was starting out, I would kind of like cherry pick who I wanted around me until I was ready to build a full-time team.
And obviously it's a really exciting time for like the industry now. What things would you say are the sort of the biggest trends that you've seen emerge, or what would you like to see in sort of like 5 or 10 years time?
There's so many trends, but will they stay? I have been on the social commerce bandwagon for about 5 years, and I would like to see it really take off. I would like to see social selling become a much bigger piece of the pie when it comes to brand growth. Because I think if you can get community selling your products, if you can get the brand selling on social platforms, I think that would be a piece that could be a game changer in the coming years because of the new technology, the new systems. I think so that would be one trend I'd like to see actually come away from being a trend and becoming a mainstay. We are all talking about how AI is impacting business in every single function, every single platform. And again, it isn't a trend. We are in an AI world now, so it's more about how do you adopt it to help build a business. So we will see more and more AI influence how businesses work. It will not replace people. It will just fuel how quickly people can work, in my opinion.
Yeah, because that's a
Then
huge
when we
worry at the
can't
moment with because marketing is obviously is a creative job, and people are worried that all of that creativity is then going to get kind of supplanted. But I see it as like you, I see it as kind of a really powerful assistant, but it should never be in the driver's seat.
Absolutely not. I mean, I often like type in a question just to see what the response is going to be. And I'm like, whoa, I would sack you immediately if you were in my team, if you sent me a document like that. But sometimes, my writing is a bit clunky. So I'll take a paragraph and I'll be like, make this sound better for me. And I'm like, oh my God, okay, I would never use words like that. I'll delete that. But actually, you've made my sentence structure better. So I actually forget to do that. But on the odd occasion when I've done that, you're like, okay, you can do that. But anyway, AI is not about just copy. AI is about the bandwidth it can add. So I've been an advisor for this incredible platform called Zelf, and now they have got this AI technology which can literally pull consumer sentiment insights on the spot and can do like consumer analysis, which normally would take a bigger company like 6 months. So at any point, you can be hearing what customers are saying about your brand. And that's going to be the difference, that you can get the immediacy and it can speed up the work that gets done. So going off tangent from you asking what trends are, it's going to just get bigger and bigger. And then when it comes to product, we're seeing already fragrance and we're seeing body becoming big. I think we're going to see body explode because up until more recent times, body has always been drugstore because if you think shower gel or what have you, it washes down the drain and people don't want to invest. But we're seeing so many more like prestige position brands coming in the body category. So that's definitely going to be an area. I think the now category is going to get bigger as well. We're seeing some really great innovation in the now category. I'm a huge hair fan. I don't even think hair has peaked. I think hair and scalp health
Yeah.
is gonna just keep growing.
It's been the skinification of hair has been sort of rattling around for a while, but do you
Couple of
think that's
years.
gonna
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely, absolutely. And I personally, have so much hair loss, and doesn't matter what drugs I take or what products I use, it comes down to health and wellness. And I think there's going to be a big understanding of your lifestyle factors that are impacting your skin and your scalp. So we're going to have the wellness phase, like the wellness understanding, take over, which is then going to trickle down to skin on the body, skin on the scalp. People are just going to become more and more educated. So these categories like hair, body, that have been bubbling for the last few years will keep growing. They're going to keep growing because people will become more educated and understand what they need to buy for their health and wellness.
For sure. We're almost at the end of our time, but what I'd love to ask is what has been for you kind of the biggest highlights of your career so far, and what's on the horizon for you in the near future?
So if I say highlights, I would say seeing people that have been in my team go off and just do amazing, amazing things, and seeing people that I have mentored become like powerhouses. And it doesn't matter what I've achieved. I have had great achievements. I've also had like major lows as well in my career, but being able to impart some of that knowledge onto others and seeing them really grow, it's amazing because you know you're impacting people. That would be a highlight. This is another highlight that is kind of a bit out there, but after having my daughter, I was telling you earlier that I stopped working, and I really wasn't sure if I'd ever get back on track, and proving that I can be an amazing mom and continue growing in my career is a highlight. Like, I wouldn't say like one specific brand or anything like that, or one activation I did. Like, there's loads of those things I loved, but it was more about showing that I could go off track and then get back on track. And then the other one was one of the reasons I started consulting 4.5 years ago was because I was laid off. And I'm a professional consultant. I'm not consulting to fill a gap. I've been consulting for a long time now. But to prove to myself again, I was able to get back on track is a huge highlight. And I would say I've probably learned more in the last 4 years than I have in the 20-year career that I've had, because I've had to learn, I've had to be accountable, I've had to keep up to date with trends, I've had to be on top of what's next. I haven't had a big corporate company backing me and putting me in training courses.
For sure. It's so scary, and just like as a entrepreneur myself, and it's like we were saying earlier, it's terrifying, isn't it, to just run
Oh, yeah.
business and then doing the work on top of the business.
And doing it. Yeah. Yeah. And then, like, most of my time, like, I'm not being paid because I'm either training or learning or networking,
For sure.
so it's a juggling act, but I would say it's a career highlight to for anyone that if you've had a moment in time where it hasn't felt right and you've been able to get back on track, like, really see that as a huge win, and know that you're really resilient.
Amazing stuff, and you've had it really, it's like a really interesting time for you. So thank you so much for joining me and taking the time to chat. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me, Viola. I've really enjoyed our time. I appreciate it.
I hope you enjoyed that episode. All links will be in the show notes, and feel free to visit smartbeautycreative.com or visit us over on Instagram to find out more about what we do. And if you enjoyed listening, please don't forget to rate and review Smart Beauty on iTunes, as it helps people find us. See you next time.